We're a fund of funds. We make sure our investors are taken care of. And then we quarterly meetings, and then we stay on top of all the financials and distributions as they come in. And so it's win, win, win all the way around, because everybody gets a little piece of the pie. The investor gets more than what they would have.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
What's going on, everyone? I'm Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday show. Today, I got another great guest with me. His name is Casey Brown. He's coming out of Tennessee, and we're talking all thing fund of funds investing. For those of you that aren't familiar with the term, essentially, they're investing in like a private placement, syndication, multifamily, but instead of being the operator, sponsor, and raising money per deal, Casey is raising money into a fund. We've had a guest on the show before that's done something similar. So he's raising it into a fund, and then his fund is placing it into other syndications of other operators. So he's vetting other operators, other syndicators based on their track record and aligned goals. And he gets to a point where he's comfortable with them, and then he brings his investors in. And so we talk about a lot of stuff. He's done a lot of different things in the real estate business. He's been in the industry since, I think he said, 05 or 06. And he started off in a transactional side of it, selling real estate. And then he talks about how he looked back in his past and he remembered when he lived in Colorado, the big home developers that would buy this plot, huge plot of land, and develop 100 of houses in this one neighborhood. And maybe they'd make 20K a pop and then take that 20K times 100, 2 million and go invest it in a long-term hold real estate. And he realized that's the strategy. I need to get out of being so transactional and something that's more sustainable, both from a business aspect and from a personal aspect. Now, that's taxing being in a constant transactional business where after you sell something, you go get the next and go get the next. And every year you're just restarting. Whereas when you can start putting some roots in some long-term real estate, that's where you grow true wealth and also true time freedom. And so that's what he decided to do. And now he has a fund of funds that invests in multifamily syndications, self-storage syndications, and mobile home park syndications as well. This is a great conversation with a great person, and I think you all will enjoy this. So let's introduce Casey. Hey, Casey, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you today?
I am great. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day to jump on with us.
Oh, man, absolutely. I'm always glad to help fellow real estate gurus out. We're always interested in learning more and hearing more and seeing what we can do to help.
I don't know. I think you're probably more of a guru than I am. You know,
I don't know.
I'm just trying to share my story and meet cool people like yourself.
Oh, man, I tell you what, I had to tell my daughters that you just said that. Somebody thought dad was cool. So, yeah, you know, everything going good with y'all today?
Yeah, it's great. We're just talking before we hit record, just how crazy the market is. So it's never a dull moment right now.
It's like, you know, we're about an hour from Nashville, Tennessee. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I didn't even remember, there was some massive number, like 220 families a day or something were moving to Nashville. And I thought, man, that's crazy. And then here we are 5 years later. I don't know if it's quite that high right now, but it's just like, it's exploded. It's just everywhere. Everything that wasn't Nashville area is now Nashville area, including across the state line, it seems like. So anyhow, but yeah, it's the market's nuts.
Everyone from California left and went to either Nashville or Austin.
Nashville or Austin. It's just like, well, yeah. And everybody's like trying to follow Tesla, I guess, to Austin. That's where they're. And somebody said that maybe even this last deal that he did is going to move their headquarters to Austin, is what I read yesterday, but I don't know.
That would be so funny. Oh, that'd be great.
It's going to be crazy. So,
well, Case, everyone loves a good origin story. So just let us know about yourself.
So, all right. I always like to kind of just give the full version, and it's the full quick version. So I was born in Kentucky and moved to Colorado when I was 2, grew up out there and watched the real estate market. Even when I was a kid, I would just see things selling and I would see the market shifting and going up and down. The Colorado Springs market particularly was built on sand almost through the dot-com era, like through the beginning and middle of the dot-com era. And there was a lot of telecommunications stuff going on there. And I remember all of a sudden my parents' house was worth this. And then all of a sudden we woke up one day and it was worth this. It literally like overnight. I don't want to say it didn't scare me. I wasn't old enough to necessarily be scared about the fact that their house had just dropped like a third in value in like a week. But what it did was it intrigued me. It intrigued me to say, what is going on and what is happening behind, what is the driving force to make this happen? Because I knew there had been an upside. You know, we had bought one and sold one and moved around and whatever. So anyway, so my eyes were set on real estate from a very young age, from a very decent perspective of a market that had some shift to it. So it wasn't like we were in Western Kentucky where I am now, where everything pretty much just rides along. I mean, it was up and down. So fast forward through college and so on, and I moved to Kentucky to do that. Graduated from Murray State University, about an hour or so away from where I live, and just decided one day I was driving down the road and I saw a real estate sign, a real regular old real estate for sale sign. And I thought, man, that'd be fun. And I didn't know that that was going to be like my true calling. I really just dove headfirst into it. I had taken a class in college, so I was able to fast track getting my license, got my license, and started actually in the broker real estate agent side of things. So I saw a lot of things through the retail side, like the agent helping the new home buyer or first-time homeowners and stuff like that. So you're seeing, and then when I started investigating like the builder side of it, I was seeing not necessarily the full-time wholesale side, if you will, but I was seeing how these two sides kind of came together. And of course, everybody thinks that home builders make huge money. Home builders move a lot of money, okay? And home building moves a lot of money. And when you build 20 that you make a certain percentage on, that's where, or 50 or 100 or however many you're building, that's where they really make money. And so when I started kind of investigating this and saying, man, what in the world, something's going on. So I started digging in. And as I dug in, what I found was most of the home builders, I wouldn't even venture to say all of the home builders in our area, but I know that's anytime you put everything in one basket, it tends to bite you in the rear end. But I'm going to say most all of a home builders in our area anyway, were building homes. And they were like, let's say they would build 100 homes and they made 20, let's say they made 15,000 or 20,000 a piece on them. Okay. Cause I feel like 20,000 was kind of our threshold for where you were profitable or not, is if you made 20 on a house. So they build 100 houses, they made 20,000 a piece on them. And what is that? Is that do the quick math for me. That's 100 times 20. So that's what, 2 million, right?
2 million, yeah.
So they would take the $2 million and then they would turn around and invest it in either building a small rental community, or they would go buy rental houses, or they would go buy something. So what they were doing was they were taking the money from the good times when the home building was good, and they were investing it back into passive income assets. Okay. So again, so we're fast forwarding from, basically just took you all through 40 years of life in 6 minutes. So, but that's like the backstory to how I got to like staring down the barrel of saying, all right, there has to be something to this real estate business or the real estate syndication business or the real estate investment passive income business.
That's a great story. So when did you finally make like the move to kind of helm the ship and go down that route?
Honestly, about 2015, I went through a nasty, nasty divorce. It was nasty mainly because father's rights are tough. They're tough to fight for. I did win. So that was definitely a blessing. But when a father has to stare at the mirror and say, hey, you either fight for the stuff that you've accumulated in the first of my adult life, the first 15 years of my adult life, or you fight for your kids, I know that not a lot of people would make the choice for the stuff. Some would. And that's neither here nor there. But the fact of the matter is that was not the decision I was going to make. So 2015, I went through a divorce. And honestly, man, the sales part of it was just getting to where, I'll be the first to admit that I had built a transactional business, what I call, and I know that's a term that a lot of people maybe or may not be familiar with. I mean, that may be actually a term that I kind of coined. I don't know. I had never really heard it before, but I had built a business that was purely based on the transaction. Okay. I would find a listing. I would find a buyer for that listing, or another agent would bring a buyer. We would sell it. I would take the $10,000 commission check. I would go put it in the bank. I would pay bills and do this and that. And then I would come back and need to go sell another house. And then I would make cash the check, pay the bills, and then I would go back. And so what happened was, as soon as And that's a great model up until you hit a turbulent time in your life. And for those of you that have never hit a turbulent time, Lord help, I hope you never do, because it's not fun. And it's not fun when you have to do things and move things and have stuff in a way you don't like it, especially if you're like me, because I like things just pretty organized. And so I had built this transactional business. And so as the turbulent time hit, and I'm now playing Mr. Mom or whatever? I can't remember that. But as I'm now having to go from at least having somebody else to rely on taking care of, helping me take care of my kids now for the better part of at least my time, I'm responsible for my time solely. Okay. Whereas we before, if you split your day in half, that's one thing. But now when you split your week in half and your month in half, now I've got half the time I have to go take care of my kids. I don't have any choice. So at that point, I was like, man, this is not going to work. I like the business. I love the business and selling and helping and putting things together and contractually negotiating and all of that stuff. So the real estate syndication world popped up to me in about, I'd say 2018, and it was just kind of by accident. And as the syndication world really became a very obvious ending point for me, or ending point for me to say, hey, this is where I'm going, because this is long-term. Okay. This is something that you gather investors and you go find an asset, and then that asset provides income for your investors, and then you invest beside them. So now all of a sudden, the money that I was investing in ads to gather customers to make a transactional business, I can now invest that in beside my investors in a real estate business and actually create not necessarily the biggest return like that, like it was with that, but I was finally able to say, okay, I can take this transactional business and I can invest these commissions into passive type stuff, kind of like the home builders were doing. And So what that boils down to, so to answer your question, which that was the long version, I guess that was the long way around to answer what you asked.
No, that was great.
Kind of like I'm going to say somewhere around 2018 is when I really, 2019 is when I really, so about three, four years ago, I had really to learn the business. And I don't know that I would necessarily encourage everybody to do this, but I'm not going to mention any names, but I found a pretty popular real estate syndicator online that all of us know. And I had taken his, so I went to Lowe's, I can't mention that name, I guess. And I bought a 4x8 sheet of, it looks like wallboard, like it goes in a bathroom, like if you're remodeling an old bathroom or something, and it's kind of slick and, you know, water will bead off of it and whatever. Anyway, that doubles, for those of you out there that might be interested, that doubles as a massive dry erase board.
Oh, okay.
So you can take dry erase markers. So I put a 4x8 sheet of this stuff up on the wall, right? And I took this PPM. So I had this, I don't know, 120 page PPM, which a private placement memorandum. And for those listeners that may or may not be completely familiar with the syndication business, the private placement memorandum basically outlines everything about how the structure of this holdings are going to be. Okay. And so I took this PPM and an operating agreement that came with it. And I went through it one page at a time, and I found different pieces of it that I thought, okay, this is something you can change. So I highlighted all of those. And then I came back and I went through it again. And I took this 4x8 sheet of whatever you call that stuff on the wall. And I took my dry erase marker and I mapped the entire thing. I mapped everything. I started halfway across the board because I used the left side of the board after I mapped the PPM and made sense of the entire structure of how this thing looked. Then I went back and I mapped the marketing funnel on the other side so that I could see the journey from the person finding out that they wanted to be a passive investor all the way through the process and the funnel that it took to get them to the point of saying, okay, hey, I'm interested in investing, all the way through the way the PPM looked and how the management companies stacked together, which I later learned called the capital stack.
Yep.
And then how debt and mezzanine debt and all that other stuff fit in there. Anyway, that's what I do for excitement on Friday night. It's, when I don't have the kids, I'm sketching out PPM. So don't let your PPM loose, because I will sketch it and map it. Okay.
Maybe I'll send it one of ours over to you. How long did that take you?
Man, honestly, about 2 weeks. And I finally had everything done. And then probably another, I'd say 4 or 5 days to sketch the marketing funnel. Of course, the marketing funnel I was super familiar with. So I was super familiar with marketing funnels. So that part didn't take long. And it was very interesting to see a working manner where, and it made a lot of sense because when you start putting the pieces together of this puzzle and you start, everybody hears, I'm going to form my corporation or LLC in Delaware. Wonderful. That's great. Do it. Delaware or Wyoming, one of the two, right? And so I thought, all right, that's cool. But what's really going on here? And then when you come back and you stack it all together and you map it and you look at how one holding company is responsible for this, and then this is responsible for this, and then your GP and your LP, how they fit in there too. It was very eye-opening and it's very logical. The thing about all of that stuff is there's a certain bit of logic that's ingrained in it. It's almost like, that's why I think engineers are so interested in passive investing specifically. And I don't mean to just call out one segment, but I don't know that I've met an engineer yet that didn't like to look at this stuff and talk about it. I'm like, guess what we do on, again, what we do on Friday nights for fun.
My partner's an engineer. So yeah, it makes sense.
You know what I'm saying, man, there's like engineers like this stuff because it's process driven.
Yep.
Exactly what you and I talked about before we started recording was process of these podcasts and the process of what we do for a living. And it's very process driven. The other part of it, and so I come from a farming community, and one of the huge benefits, I know there's a certain element of this that you have to be careful with because quote unquote farmers feed the world. We all know that and we're all thankful for that. But the other part of farming is, and a guy told me this several years ago, a farmer, anything that he buys is not bought on what it's going to do this year. It's bought on what it's going to do for 10 years. Because in farming, the only thing that is predictable is it's predictable in 10-year increments, okay? Does that make sense? So you can predict what the average yield of a certain type of soil is going to be for 10 years. You can't predict what it's going to be for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. You right. predict what it's going to be for 10 years. So when you start living on that 10-year average, your life becomes very predictable and your income becomes very predictable. Same thing with housing. It's the same thing with real estate. When you start looking at the 10-year trends and don't worry about the 07s, 08s, 08's the worst financial disaster of my lifetime. But do you know what? I would go back any day of the, I would buy any piece of real estate at a 2006 price today.
Oh yeah.
Even though in 08, it was just treacherous. Everybody in the world was mad at everybody. It was terrible. But I can guarantee you that when you start looking at that at a 10-year average, there's not a single human on this planet that wouldn't have in 2016 paid a 2006 price for a piece of property or a house or whatever.
Right.
So 10-year averages, as you look at that 10-year average and you move across, you said this was going to be on speaker mode, so it's going to be all me. You're not even going to be on there.
Oh, that's fine. That's the point. You're killing it. I love the information. I like that you're thinking like 10 years out, because that's how you should be, because we can't...
Not 10 years out. I'm talking about a
10-year average, I mean, right?
Yeah.
Because we don't know what rates can do tomorrow or in a year, but on average, we know what they're going to do in a 10-year cycle. We know what prices are generally going to do in a 10-year cycle. And I think that's the way we all have to look at it. And that's the way we look at when we're underwriting properties. Based on information we know and the averages, where is this going to be? Especially important now. I don't know how you guys are doing anything different now when it comes to this current market in terms of underwriting. But you got to be able to make changes when environments like this come up.
Yeah. The reality of the situation is, and it's just exactly what I just kind of alluded to. I don't even know that I alluded to. I think I said it directly, but it's everybody's like, oh my gosh, it's so high. It's so high. How's anybody going to make it? Well, I got to have a little meat on the bone, or I got to have, you hear all kinds of different, whatever
it is. They said that 2-3 years ago too.
Yeah. And you know, when else they said that? Like 04, 05, 06. Oh my, these things are so high. Everything. Yeah. It's out of sight. It's out of sight. And even all I've ever heard, of course, coming from a farming community, there's a term that really, like, if you want to hear a farmer give you a good cussing, all you got to do is mention the 1980s. Like, you just have to say those words, the 1980s. It's like they all get, it's like they just lose their minds, right?
Yeah.
And so because interest was here, everything was up. Payments, inflation was out of this world, apparently.
Energy prices were up.
Everything was up. Everything. And when you stop and you think, okay, but from that point forward, from the 1980s, okay, the government, believe it or not, our government actually did do a good job doing something. I know it's hard to believe for a lot of people, but the government has put in place a lot of stuff in the banking system. And I don't know that interest rates are ever going to be like they once were. And again, with that being said, could they go to 7-8%? Yeah, absolutely. I don't know that our economy's back could handle much more than that. Plus, with the creation of the housing of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and those kinds of things, I don't know that they're going to allow that. That's going to would I guess. Do you say physically allow or it would not allow that to happen? I guess is what. So it just makes things. But yeah, when you say 1980s and then you start like and then they all start cussing and I'm like, okay, would you not take that farm over there? The farm that so-and-so bought, would you not take that at the 1984-5 price? I mean, you know, it's gone up, been nothing but gone up since. And so that's what I'm getting at. You look at things, you stand at year five and you've got 5 years behind you and 5 years in front of you, you can make your life very predictable.
Yeah, it's true because it's exactly why there's different durations in the bond market, right? Because it's
has to be
over a different spread of time. And that hits on your point of the interest rates too. It's like, yeah, they're most likely going to go up, but I don't believe they're going to go up to where they have in the past. I don't think it's currently where we have debt levels that are in this country. I just don't think it's sustainable and the way that Fed has acted. And on top of that, if you look at how the bond is pricing right now, the market, it's showing that Fed fund rate will get to about 3% by the end of 2023. And then it's also pricing in that there's going to be some type of like drawback once we get into 2024. Now, will that happen? Who knows?
I feel like as long as everybody's worried about war and those kinds of things, and those are the things that we can't necessarily control. But if you look back from, again, if you start back at like, let's even say 9/11, and that was recently 20 years ago, last year, when you look at 9/11 and you look at the interest rate controls, like we had every opportunity or the economy had every opportunity to flush us out. 18, 19, 20, 21% interest, like those circumstances and everything that was put there, I feel like if there weren't controls in place, we would have most definitely been standing in a soup line. I mean, a lot of people don't realize how detrimental that was to our economy, just the wars themselves. I mean, not even what's actually going on here, but just shipping stuff out and the sheer amount of people that weren't here, the staff that it took to do. So what I'm getting at is, and I don't want this not political in any way, it just is an economical fact, that stuff being gone left us over here like, what do we do now?
Right.
So I feel like that's another hedge factor in my honest opinion. That's why I don't mind looking at things that only have a 5-year fixed mortgage rate and then either, you know, balloon after five and force you to refinance, because again, it could potentially cut into some of your profit. But if you buy something with a decent enough return, I just don't feel like they can let interest rates get that far out of hand without just completely just crashing everything.
Right.
Food prices to the whole nine, if they're there, everything.
I agree. And you still have to be very cognizant of the fact that we're in a rising rate environment. But I agree. I don't think it's going to go completely out of whack.
Yeah. Like I said, you're spot on. We're in a rising rate. I mean, there's no way around it. I mean, I think it has to come up some. But again, when they control how many millions or billions or whatever of bond, and that's control both ways. That's not just short or long. That's both ways. They really manipulate that. But again, it's made people want to invest in this real estate market at whatever level, because they're getting a typical CD at your bank of what, like 1/8% or something. Yeah,
it's crazy. You might as well just burn it, right?
Just go buy gold and watch it and play with it.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, I got a few kids that I'll sell to. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just invest in them. Invest in my kids. So no. But yeah, man, it's definitely been a ride, I think, for everybody since I started in 06, 07 selling real estate. So
yeah,
it's been a wild ride since, and definitely educational for sure. So,
and now you're syndicating, what is it, large multifamily complexes?
Actually, I'm going to step back just a little bit, what we are, how we're doing, what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are a fund of funds.
Okay.
And let me explain that just a little bit for the listeners that may or may not understand what that is. And to put that into what I call layman's terms, is to say we are in investor relations. We're an investor relations business. Why? Because there's a number of reasons why. The average investor that is sitting in Amarillo, Texas, or, and I don't mean to call out Amarillo, I love Amarillo, or sitting in wherever, New Jersey, and they come across a syndicator that's a fast talker, that's a very good at sales or whatever, and they're like, yeah, I want you to invest with us. Now, we're buying a unit in, we're buying a 200 units in, let's just go back and say Austin, right? Okay, what does this person in New Jersey know about the Austin market? What if the Austin market, there's so many different things that they need to be due diligent about before investing with one person in a market that they don't know just because he has good marketing material, right?
Yeah.
What that's, when we step back and we say, okay, hey, why don't you let us do the vetting? Why don't you let us find the operators, let us talk to the operators, and let us negotiate better terms than what you could get with your single $50,000 investment, okay? You invest $50,000, and this is just purely examples, okay? Invest $50,000 with one operator at, say, a, and say this, all right, you invest $50,000 with us, that's our minimum. We're going to get you Class B share at a 7% pref, okay? 7% pref, 80-20 split, right? Or let's say 70-30 split, 7% pref, 80-30 split. So then we go and we say, okay, hey, we've got 10 people that have let us vet these operators, or then we go to the operators that we've vetted and we say, all right, I've got a $500,000. I've got 10 people that have $50,000 apiece. I've got a $500,000 that I can bring to your deal. What can you do for me? Well, all right, well, we'll give you an 80% pref, or we'll give you an 8% pref with an 80-20 split. Okay. So then as the fund of funds, we get a small cut of that. But at the same time, our investors with the same $50,000 that they were going to invest to begin with, they're going to get an extra whatever it is on top. Whether we may say, hey, you all keep the pref, we'll split the additional extra, you know, whatever, the each deal is different.
Right.
What I'm getting at is it allows us to negotiate on part of our investors and provide our duty to our investors to do that. And then it also provides the operator the reason why he can do that and operate under side letters, because now he doesn't have to provide the relationship management with the investors. It's a win-win-win-win for everybody, because the operator has us standing with our investors. Okay. The investor knows that we have these processes in place that we've detailedly gone through with them and said, hey, we check operators for all of these circumstances, for all of this and all of that. And then we get a little cut in the middle. The operator gets the money, fewer calls to make, fewer people to keep happy on a daily basis, and everybody's good. Okay.
Yeah.
And then we know that this operator has had, you know, for instance, one of our things that we want our operators to have is at least 7 years in the actual syndication business, and, or the actual, I don't want to say syndication business, because I don't know that it's necessarily been around. It hasn't necessarily been around long enough for everybody to have 7 years, but I mean 7 years in the active management of properties business, if you will.
Yeah. Operating real estate. Yeah.
Correct. Operating. And then, you know, capital raising stuff's been around forever. I mean, these, a lot of these guys are doing it. It's the way business has been built. We're just all finding out about it through the syndication world, because it doesn't have to be run as like an IPO or whatever.
You have to register under the SEC.
Correct. So that's what we do. We're a fund of funds. We make sure our investors are taken care of. And then we quarterly meetings, and then we stay on top of all the financials and distributions as they come in. And so, like I said, it's win, win, win all the way around, because everybody gets a little piece of the pie. The investor gets more than what they would have had they just taken their money directly to one operator. And now all of a sudden, this investor with his $50,000 investment, he's diversified across, we specialize with three operators. So now he's diversified across three operators, across multiple geographical markets with each operator, that each operator is very cognizant of what that geographical market represents and how to move around in it, and so on and so forth. And then they're fully diversified. All their eggs aren't in one basket.
No, that's great, because that's true diversification within an asset class. You're getting different geographies, different operators. And the cool part is that once the investor vets you. You've already vetted all the other operators. So it's
right.
When it comes to syndication, that's the biggest thing to me. Like, yes, you have to do diligence on the property and the deal itself, but first you have to do it on the operator. That's the biggest risk, in my opinion.
That's exactly right, man. Because I'll tell you, when you start looking at these operators, and one of our prerequisites, I guess, if I could, that's a huge word for me, is that we like to see an actual property that the operator's been running for a given amount of time. And I don't even know if we have a specific amount of time, but I like quality of life stuff. Okay.
Yep.
Because if you go down and you're like, his tenants, like, damn, they won't fix anything. They won't help me do this. They won't do that. Now, that's one tenant could be the one bad apple, right? But then you find a couple more. You just don't even tell, you don't even say anything about who you are. Maybe you act like you're going to rent something there or something like that. You just try to get an idea of what the quality of life is. And the quality of life of the tenant is going to ultimately be the quality of the life of the investor. That's going to depend on whether the investor is going to end up being frustrated and mad. Or because if you think about it, the tenant is almost an investor anyway. You know what I'm saying? The tenant is paying the rent and they're investing their life in this.
100%.
They're not necessarily making a monetary investment or something like that. But what I'm getting at is that I feel like that tenant-investor relationship, even though they don't know each other, they don't know anything about each other, is fairly parallel because they're both reliant on one person. And if one of them is mad at that person, or if three of them are mad at that one person, there's a pretty good chance that you want to just maybe kind of steer clear. And you did make mention there, I forgot, as I got to talking there, you made mention of asset class. Now, we actually, to take it one step out, our operators specialize in three different areas.
Okay.
So we're multifamily, self-storage, and believe it or not, mobile home parks.
Yep. All great asset classes.
Mobile home parks is a completely different podcast for a complete different day, believe me. But because you could just dive into any number of reasons why it's absolutely astonishingly brilliant to own a mobile home park. But again, different discussion for a different day. But what I'm getting at is those are the three asset classes. So you're diversified across operators, geography, and asset classes.
That's great. And let me tell you, the point you made on investing in the tenant, there's no... It's not a more rewarding feeling, if that's the right way to say the term,
100%.
Than walking onto a property and the tenant thanking you for like improving
yep.
the community they call home. And like that's in our mission statement too, is to create award-winning homes that tenants love to call home and to positively improve the lives of anyone that comes into contact with us. So
yep.
that's important to me. I'm glad you brought that up because at the end of the day, everyone wants to be proud of where they call home. And at the end of the day, they want to be able to go home and be happy that they're going home.
That's right. And, you know, and as an investor, what investor wants to be part of something where everything is trash? What investor wants to be part of something that somebody hates to go? Like, if you just despised going home, do you think my investor is going to love going there and visiting the property and seeing? So I'm really big on quality of life stuff, man. That's first and foremost. And that even goes back to when I was in the single family rental space. I mean, your tenants have to, and you have to hold them in the regard that, hey, they really are paying the bills. At the end of the day, the tenant is the one that's paying the bills because the tenant moves out. And I've always said, we remember those days, and I know you remember those days when there was big canvas signs draped over the side of these apartment buildings that said free plasma TV with the signing of a year lease. I mean, those days were not that far separated from those days.
Right.
Not far enough for me to forget them anyway. And so the tenant at the end of the day does pay the bills. And to me, you just have to do right by them as a human.
Exactly.
That's worth anything. It's, and that's not a big return item, but it, to me, it is.
Yeah. And we may technically own the building, but it's their home. And we got to remember that.
That's exactly right. 100%.
I couldn't agree more. I'm really glad you brought that up. That's a really cool model. So I like how you also have these prerequisites. Like, you're not just going to go place money with any operator. No. I think that's very important. It's not even just the fact like that these operators have to have a track record, but it's also the fact it sounds like you got to mesh with them when it comes to morals and values and ultimately what your goal is for you and your investors. So
yeah. And, you know, it's the same. It's just, I think everybody, the job that I had when I was in college was, I look at that as, it was the job. There was a guy that worked there that I just, when I walked by him, I just had to bite my tongue. And sometimes I would, sometimes I wouldn't. And he was one of those guys that just made every day absolutely as miserable as he possibly could for everybody around him. And it's a lot the same way. And who wants to do that? So why would I want to go in with somebody that just gets up to make life difficult? We've all been around those people that get up just to make life difficult for everybody around them. And I'm like, the stage of my life, why? Why put yourself through that? So I try to keep us and our investors, we stay away from that kind of stuff. So,
well, that's great. Well, I have a question for you. You see a lot of deals, obviously, because you're working with a different operator. So selfishly, I have some questions.
Yep.
In terms of like capital stack, what are you seeing in this current market in terms of type of debt that's being used on these deals and how the equity sleeve of that is looking in terms of return profile?
Well, I'll tell you. So obviously the cap rates are compressing. They're getting smaller and smaller. And I'll be honest, just to kind of give a precursor to where I'm going with this part of the discussion, there is a thought and there is a bit of reasoning somewhere that says that cap rates always have to be positive. And I've got news for people out there. Cap rates, there's a chance that they're not going to stay positive. Okay, because the rate of inflation, when the rate of inflation outrises the cost of losing 1% on an investment up front in the cash flow, that's a reality. And that's a reality that could be coming sooner than later. Okay, so to think that somebody's going to buy an asset to lose money on the cash flow is crazy, right? That's the thought. And that's the way we've been pricing these things. But the truth of the matter is that the cost of the money. So then you start looking at, okay, are they going to buy these properties based on cash flow or are they going to buy these properties based on potential appreciation? Okay. So that's the first part of that is the thought that cap rates always have to be positive. And that's, again, the possibility of that remaining true is getting slimmer and slimmer by the day. Now, with that being said, the types of debt I feel like that are still highly beneficial to a lot of people is still the government-backed Fannie and Freddie, those types of loans. And again, the structure of those loans is still kind of, what am I trying to say? Like the way that those loans are structured is going to play big in a few years. I don't think you're going to see a lot of difference right now, but when they start doing interest only and that kind of stuff, in the refinancing of something at an appreciated value, again, I think all of that stuff is going to come to play at some point down the road. Now, with the capital stack, and you start looking at regular debt, or you start looking at equity ownership, regular debt, mezzanine debt, that kind of stuff. When you're in an equity position, you're in the position that is really kind of first to evaporate if values don't hold enough to pay off those mortgage, that debt. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, I mean, when these investors come in, and that's just something to be very, very mindful of. But again, that's why your operator has to have the same kind of, you need to be on the same timeline as them. Again, remember the 10-year period. Because if you're like, hey, I want to go with a short-term person, that capital stack needs to probably look a little bit different. Wouldn't you agree?
Correct.
And then if you're going to go with something that's like a 10-year fund or 10-year something like that, the capital stack can be a little more liberal as far as how much debt you bring on with refinances and whatever else. So that's the equity position is got to be oh so careful with it, especially right at these levels. Although everybody talks about this being an opportunity. It's an opportunity to buy. Like 3 years ago, you're right. Nobody wanted to buy. But now you look at it and you're like, all right, are we still at an opportunity? And that's something that has to be a judgment call.
Right. Yeah. And to your point of going close negative cap rates, it's going to make it harder to, because like you said, it's going to go to cash flow in the red for a given period of time. And it's going to make it hard to pay a pref, which a lot of investors, well, essentially impossible, but it's what a lot of investors are used to. So are you still seeing most deals with a juicy pref right now?
Mm-hmm. And I don't know. That's part of the reason why we've locked in with who we've locked in with, because among our three operators, we're 7 to 10%, 7% on the low side of just one part of one deal. So I have to throw that in there because I don't want to act like it's not there. I would like to act like it's not there because I want a 12 or 15% pref, but nevertheless, 7 to 10%. And so across our deals, now we give our fund operates through a completely separate PPM. We pay our pref is handled as just a one figure out of our PPM. So we have to average these other three. But
right.
Again, the other thing about this is, and so many people, and again, anybody that comes to me will find that I'm a brunt of honest. There's no sense in not calling the elephants out in the room, because if not, you're never going to build trust with people. But the fact of the matter is, people that are especially just coming into this business, pref is not guaranteed. That pref is there. That pref is talked about a lot, but that pref is not guaranteed.
Right.
And the only thing that's guaranteed is that you're going to get paid before the manager gets paid.
Right.
To a certain degree, depending upon how that's all written. But that's neither here nor there, because every deal is different. But again, you have to be oh so careful with that.
Yeah, you do. I agree. In my opinion, I think we're going to see those prefs decline as it gets tighter and tighter. And I think investors are going to have to get, well, they will get more comfortable with it, yep. Right?
I don't think they're going to have a choice, because it's either that or step, when you start charting risk versus reward, you're still not going to find an asset class, an investment asset class quite that's tied to something that's never going to be worth zero.
Right.
If that makes sense. I mean, I always said, well, it could be worth zero if the apartment building burns down. Well, the apartment building burned down, you still got a lot.
You still got some insurance too. And you get an insurance payment.
You've got that kind of stuff. So you're in a class that is theoretically not going to be worth, not ever going to be worth zero. So,
right. Yeah.
Whether it's a short play or a long play, that's what you have to determine.
Exactly. The reason why we're seeing cap rates compress, but prices rise, well, there's a lot of factors, but a major one is that people still need to yield, right? Like they're chasing right. yield, and you can't get it in the bond market right now. It's just, it's crazy. So not only investors like us are chasing yield in real estate, but then you got big institutional players like pension funds, insurance companies, and they don't need as high as a pref that you and I do, right?
Those bond investors have been dealing with the negative
rates,
the negative returns for a long time. They just now getting the problem with that getting out into the retail world is people don't understand it.
Right.
That's the biggest issue. Well, why am I going to invest in something that's got a negative initial return? Coming into the retail market, this just people just don't understand it. But it's been yep. there for a long time for people that were like, hey, I'm going to buy into these 30-year bonds because they have to go up.
Right. Couldn't agree more. Well, I've got a final question, but before I ask it, where can people find you if they want to reach out? I know you got a new podcast, so that's probably one of them.
So yeah, my podcast is Cashflow Pro, and it's www.cashflow.pro, no.com, but .pro. You can also reach me, just shoot me an email. I mean, that's really, honestly, especially if it's somebody that just wants to learn more about fund of funds or whatever, casey@3000capital.com. We're glad to help. And man, it's been just a pleasure to be on here. I hope I didn't like take over the show and talk too much.
No, that's what these shows are about, to get some knowledge from experts like you that are doing this day in and day out. So
we certainly try and we make it happen. We hope we do anyway. So
that's right. All right. Last two questions for you. If you're someone that's trying to get into this space, whether it's from an active or passive side, and they just need to know more about the syndication business, what type of resource would you recommend, whether that be a book, a podcast, YouTube channel, whatever it happens to be, where would you send someone?
The first most boring place, since my two places, is it okay if I get a plug to somebody else on here?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
The first place I would send somebody is to any PPM you can get your hands on. Okay. The PPM is the driest, most lame document that you will ever place your time in reading. But I'm going to tell you, if you pick up a PPM, I've met some very competent attorneys that do this. I don't know that I've met an incompetent attorney yet that's in this space. So any of these attorneys that wrote these things up, they're all going to have the same gist to them. But you have to read and understand that, okay? Especially if you're going to be leading people with that PPM, because that PPM is basically the glue that holds you and your investors together. So the first thing you have to understand is how that works, and then how that ties with the operating agreement and how it ties everything together. Okay. You have to understand that. The second place I would go, and this book is going to cover everything from how you sharpen your pencil to how you used that sharpened pencil to sign on the loan documents on the 800 unit complex you just bought. Okay. This book covers everything. And that's Joe Fairless's book, Best Ever Apartment Syndication Guide, I think is what it's called. Best ever.
I have it somewhere around here.
I have it too. And I've read it probably three times. And then the last time I read it, I actually jumped around just to try to, it's been a couple years ago when I did it, but
that's essentially a textbook.
Yeah, you can do, and I mean, make notes and draw on. And I can assure you that Joe, I talked to him the other day. I mean, he's still actively in the business. I say he knows everything. He's really just a super nice guy. And you can tell his ease of writing through that book makes for an ease of learning from your perspective. And again, if you want the complete guide, that is the complete guide. Again, that's everything from how to run a meetup to how to put on a conference to how to hold a podcast to how to what to look for in your documents, what attorneys to look for. There's one more plug I'd like to give for a guy. He's an attorney in California. His name's Gene Trowbridge. Gene yep. wrote a book, and I don't know the title of it right off. Do you know it?
I don't know the title. No, I don't.
But it was very from, if you can figure out a way, like
sure, we can link it in the show notes too.
Yeah, do that.
I'll have them look it up.
Joe's book is kind of like the outlet on the wall, and Gene Trowbridge's book is kind of the end of the extension cord that plugs into it. I mean, they both go together really well. And part of Gene's knowledge about all of this stuff is fairly well. And I will say that if somebody that just for a quick something here, but somebody that wants to look at doing funds needs to have a different type of attorney than somebody wanting to do like a one-off syndication. So yeah, there are a couple of different laws there that come into place.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I agree. And another good one was good content is Mauricio Raul. His company's called Premier Law Group. He's another good one. He has a YouTube channel. Follow him on Facebook. Him and Gene are two of the top guys out there.
They've probably been around the longest.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the reason people file in Delaware. It's because the laws are very straightforward. They've been around the longest. They've been on the books the longest. And it's the same way with Gene. And what'd you just
Mauricio.
Say?
Mauricio. Yeah.
Mauricio. Lord, I knew it, but I couldn't think of it. They've been around long enough that they know the ins and outs of everything. Yep.
Couldn't agree more. All right. Last question.
Yep.
If you had a DeLorean and could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of financial advice, because after all, this is not only a multifamily investment podcast, but a personal finance one as well. What would be that one piece of financial advice you'd give your younger self?
All right. So can I make two stops in my DeLorean?
Oh, of course. Where's the first one going
to
be?
My wife is going to, when she listens to this episode, she's going to know exactly one of those stops is going to be. That's going to be at Tupac's last concert in 1996.
The first Were you stop. There?
No, I want to be.
You just want to be. Okay. Can I sit on someone's lap in that two-seater and go with you guys?
Backseat the DeLorean or not. We can kick Doc out. We'll make it happen.
Okay.
The second place I would stop for a piece of financial advice would probably be to research and look closer at the .com, the internet in general, in like 1999. And what's the... Basically, Google guys were just kind of getting rolling. And honestly, man, it was right there in front of all of our faces. Like, it was right here. It was staring at us like, hey, here I am. I'm the internet. I'm going to rule this world. Oh, instead, we focused on the bust right after that. And if the bust right after that, everything should have been bought up by one, you know, just whoever wanted to be in the long play of that game. Because I think it was overbought because so many people didn't understand it. Like, again, when it hit retail, people just didn't understand it. They didn't know what it was good for.
I agree.
To say financial advice, I would definitely say, look at internet investing. And who wouldn't say real estate investing? I mean, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. Where it's gone.
And I say 99, 2000. That's when I graduated high school. So
I think there's some similarities what's happening in the blockchain and NFT space. Like, there's a lot of garbage and scammy stuff out there right now, for sure. And it's something that I haven't gotten into, but I also think there is some value there that in the long term.
When you start thinking about blockchain is just the kind of quasi physical part of the way we've traded goods all along. And I say quasi because obviously it's programming and it's tied together among servers. And so the chain between them is, but it's really in like 2005 or six, when I was in commodities trading, they talked about e-contracts. You know, the e-contract was really big, and the Chicago Mercantile was investing massively into turning this e-contract stuff into reality. And again, it was kind of like if blockchain had been around then, I feel like they would have really, and I think the e-contract stuff it's just took on a different form, I believe. I don't think it necessarily kind of came to fruition like they wanted it to back then.
Right.
But yes, you're right. The NFT stuff blew up until it reached that border of people that understood it. Now, for it to continue growing, people that don't understand it have to buy into it. Yep. And that's where it's at right now.
Right. I agree. So it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. But yeah, fun times. But
yeah, man, that's great.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, man, I really appreciate it. And like I said, my wife says I talk too much, and I guess I proved it today. So
no, it was fun, though. You brought a lot of value, so I don't think anyone's going to mind.
But yeah, man, anybody drop me a line, send me an email, let me know if there's something we can do to help. And I hope everybody has a wonderful rest of the day.
Thanks, man. You as well. And listeners, thanks for tuning in as always, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.